White people do not listen to us. They only listen to one another. Yes, we need white people. We did not create this problem. They did. It is up to them to fix it. Talk to your racist ass grandma and grandpa. Talk to your racist ass husband. Welcome to Dear Culture, the podcast that gives you news you can trust for the culture. I'm your co-host, Shauna Pinnock, social media director at The Griot.
And I'm your co-host, Jaron Keith Gaynor, managing editor at The Griot. And this week we're asking, Dear Culture, is it time we start taking youth activists more seriously?
Before we even get into the whole show, Jaron, let me know what is on your mind this week.
You know, Shauna, with just weeks away from the 2020 election, all I can think about is the election, obviously, but more specifically what's happening in California. And I know that you are very much aware of what's happening there. So just to give our listeners a brief run through, the Republicans in California have been instituting these mail drop-in boxes where people take their ballots and they put them in the boxes. It sounds pretty harmless. However, it's a bit partisan because the reality is that the Board of Elections is in charge of the elections in these states, not the parties themselves. And so just imagine a party that has a stake in the election that wants to see Republicans elected in their state, and more importantly, wants to see the Republican president reelected, Donald Trump, having the power to collect said ballots and presumably turn them over to the Board of Elections. Now, one could say that they're just trying to be good patriots and help the elections to turn in the ballots. But obviously, people are looking at it sideways and saying, hey, this is a bit alarming because how do we know that they're not throwing the ballots out? And so the Attorney General Xavier Becerra and the Secretary of State Alex Padilla, they have not only ordered the GOP to get rid of these boxes, but they're saying that it's illegal. So the party obviously is standing by their decision. They're saying that they have the legal right to do this. So it begs the question, why is it that Republicans don't want to see certain groups voting, whether it be Black people, whether it be young people, the elderly, particularly elderly Black women who show out in droves during any election? And this is a pattern that we're seeing from the Republican Party, not just from ballot harvesting, which has happened in North Carolina in 2018, during a North Carolina House seat where a Republican operative was collecting ballots from people on the behalf of the candidate. He was hired by the Republican candidate to collect the ballot. And so it comes off obviously very biased and sinister almost, because why are you not just relying on the Board of Elections to handle these things? But this is what we've been seeing from Republicans for about, I would say, the better part of two decades when it comes to voter suppression. And I just want to go through the list of things that Republicans have been doing systematically across the country. That is, they've been trying to reduce ballot drop-offs. The Texas governor, Greg Abbott, was ordered by a judge to not institute his limit on mail ballot drop-offs. Why would you want to reduce the amount of drop-off sites? You should want people to exercise their most basic right in America, which is to vote. You have the president almost even saying, do not vote by mail, saying that it is going to lead to voter fraud, when we know that there's probably less than 1% of cases where there's been voter fraud. You have Republicans trying to reduce early voting. They've been redistricting the maps, changing the maps to benefit Republicans so that districts are more Republican leaning. They've been passing voter ID laws where they say you can't have certain IDs when you show up to vote, when they know that Black people more often than white people tend to not have certain types of IDs. And so just weeks before an election, when you hear about Republicans collecting ballots weeks before November 3rd, it makes you really question what the hell is going on. And so it makes me scared about this election. Obviously, you've been seeing early voting going on in Georgia and elsewhere, and people are lined up and they're ready to vote. A lot of Black people. And that makes me really excited about the 2020 election. However, I still worry there's still that dark cloud that's over this election of what Republicans are willing to do, lie, cheat, and steal this election.
The devil works hard, but Republicans work harder, okay? That's all I'm going to say. yeah, so for me, it's been looking for different forms of escapism during this really shitty time in our lives. And I've spoken about this before. I will talk about it till the end. You know, Lovecraft Country is a show after my own blurred heart. And, you know, for me, it's been literally going back and starting from episode one. So if you've been following Lovecraft Country, you know, if you haven't been paying attention, it is very easy to be like, what the hell is going on here, right? But I think one of the most impactful episodes that that show has was definitely like the retelling of the Tulsa Race Massacre. And so for me, it was watching, yes, like there were white people out here just running up on black folks, like killing them, shooting them in the head, shooting children, like beating them for what? Just because of jealousy and hatred and real, frankly, for me, mental health problems. Like y'all are crazy, right? And it reminded me so much of Tamika Mallory's speech that she gave right around the George Floyd protest, where she said, yeah, remember the whole big thing about AutoZone being burned down and these riots and whatever else. And she said, don't talk to me about looting. Don't talk to me about burning down AutoZone. She's like, we learned looting from you. Y'all have looted black people. Y'all have looted Native Americans since the dawn of time. So don't talk to me about violence. We learned violence from you. I love that line. And I would ever quote my sister, Tamika D. Mallory, because of that. And you know, what's so funny is shortly after I saw that episode, there was this image that was floating around on Twitter where it was basically like, it shows a map and it's like, pick a massacre and research it. And we're talking about like the 1943 Detroit race massacre, the 1919 Chicago race massacre. Apparently there was a whole shit ton of race massacres happening in the 1800s, you know, from Atlanta to Memphis to New Orleans, you know, there was Rosewood, et cetera, et cetera. And it occurred to me, we don't know the vast majority of these. I learned about the Elaine, Arkansas massacre because we were creating a post for the Griot's Instagram. Never heard of it before then. I knew of Tulsa. The only reason why I knew of Tulsa was because I had a black global history teacher who taught me that in high school. I was a sophomore in high school before I learned about Tulsa Race Massacre. We know about Charlottesville because that was just, what, 5 years ago? And we were there for it. Where are the rest? And it's infuriating to me how easy it is for our history to be whitewashed, right? And so we are taught that, oh, well, there's black on black crime and blah, blah, blah. And you all are inherently violent. And you all are inherently savage and all this other stuff. But I'm like, y'all were over here raping, pillaging, and plundering since the beginning. But even then, you saw us making the little bit of strides that we could make. And it was your determination to tear that shit down because for them, we don't deserve anything more. And on the one hand, where I'm so proud of my people because this shit keeps happening. And what do we keep doing? We keep rising, we keep getting better, we keep getting bigger, right? But I'm real sick and tired of white people acting, throwing stones and hiding their hands. I'm real sick and tired of it. So that was just my little bit of thoughts. And yeah, I have a feeling I'm going to make that a bigger thing to explore. Coming soon to thegriot.com. Let's go.
My op is for thegriot.com because your opinions are always fiery, as our listeners know. There's a lot at stake in the election, and there's a lot still to uncover and to highlight when it comes to race in America. And so I really love Craft Country because there's a bit of escapism in the storyline, but it also forces us, I think particularly forces white people, to see that even in a fictional world where there's magic and other things that we love to see in sci-fi films, that if you're black, you have to face racism. And that is something that we have to see every day, that our ancestors had to endure in far greater ways. But there's hope. There's hope for the future. And I hope that, you know, our generation and the generations after us are able to really bring change to this country and the world.
So, Jaren, as you know, this has been an extremely heavy year for all of us, right? So dealing with unjust police brutality, to COVID, to the, how do I say this in a politically correct way? Very polarizing leadership, to say the least, in Washington, D.C. So one exercise we've seen consistently on full display during this time and hell even before is activism, right? So specifically from the youngest among us, let's talk about exactly what does youth activism look like and is important.
You know, Shauna, I'm really glad we're talking about activism because one of the most interesting evolutions that we've seen in regards to activism is digital activism. We see it all over social media in the forms of hashtags, trending topics, and photos. And we've also seen it in memes and GIFs and even quotes from celebs. However, it hasn't always been embraced. In fact, it was originally called lazy activism. How do you feel now about this form of protest?
So for me, because my entire life is on social, you know, my life, my job, everything, I understand the power that social media, the power that online activism has, right? Because let's be very clear, like even the Black Lives Matter movement. So, you know, that got started pretty much because of Trayvon. But remember how it really kind of got its legs was the killing of Mike Brown. And we didn't know what was happening, you know, and we had no clue except for Twitter. Twitter was informing us. Twitter was letting us know what was happening. I think in an age of where, especially with media, it's not hard to think that nothing is happening and people don't care, right? It's very easy to believe, like, no one gives a shit. But there have been endless days of protests since the killing of George Floyd. You wouldn't know that though. Why? Because what, 98, 99% of them are nonviolent and they're peaceful and it's just people letting their voices be heard. So because there's no burning downs of auto zones and, you know, no one's shooting cops or, you know, there's not these violent things happening. So it doesn't get coverage. So you think that everyone's just asleep now. Hell no. Oregon is still out here protesting. You know, they're still out here protesting in Louisville for Breonna, you know, still out here protesting for George, still out here protesting for Ahmaud. Endless amounts of people that, especially, well, Black people that have lost their lives, especially to police brutality, especially, and really at the end of the day, just racism in general. However, with that being said, it is very easy for those forms of protests and forms of activism to become performative. Mm. And when I say that, I mean, I have seen a number of celebs, white celebs, who were posting black boxes, you know, and saying, oh, you gotta buy black and blah, 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 blah. We're gonna leave Facebook for 24 hours and we're not gonna post, but we're still posting on Instagram. Still owned by the same company, but whatever, you know, but we're not gonna do anything on Facebook for 24 hours. And all of these things where then you're like, wait a minute, time out. Hold up. Flag on the play. You don't talk about this shit, no timeout. One, two, as soon as it was cool, as soon as it was supposed to go unnoticed, right? All of a sudden those black boxes disappeared. All of a sudden those posts got archived because it didn't fit with your aesthetic and your appeal. I've especially seen that from certain influencers who have never said anything political, have never said anything in terms of social activism. But when the movement was going on and strong and everybody's real angry and incensed, hell, we saw companies do that. And then they went right back to the same old, same old. I give you a perfect example. Cops got canceled. Do we remember this? We remember this. Cops got canceled after decades and decades and decades of what you gonna do when they come for you, right? Because, oh, it's just not the time and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we're being sensitive to that. I'm sorry. Cops just got renewed. Because shit is cool again. You know what I mean? It's very easy for social, and I mean social in terms of like social media, it's very easy for social activism to become co-opted. It's very easy for it to become performative, but I think it is important and is still necessary. In all honesty, I believe that those who are actually out here fighting the good fight, and making good on their word, and who are out in the streets and who are also making sure that, yeah, we're going to post this. Yeah, we're going to make sure this hashtag is trending. You know, we wouldn't know anything that was going on in Nigeria right now unless you had Nigerian relatives or you were watching like BBC News. You know, this entire end SARS thing, I found out because of social media. So I choose to believe that it has more positives than negatives, but I do recognize the negatives and I hope that they never outweigh the positives. What about you, G?
Absolutely. I think that social media has become like this great equalizer to the point that you've made. It brings us all together and we're able to find out what's happening in real time from those who are on the ground. So a lot of times it's like citizen journalism and They're simply sharing what's happened. And then there's the other part of it where we can build campaigns using social media to bring awareness, which is how we came up with hashtag Black Lives Matter. It became like this rallying cry. And then obviously it morphed into, you know, a phenomenon in itself. But to your point, it's important to not see it as trendy, as something that's cool. It looks good now for a lot of celebs, especially white celebs, to speak out against racial injustice, because now we're having national conversations about race. We're talking about it on the stage where presidential candidates are discussing important topics and issues that are happening in America. We're seeing companies release statements and donating a lot of money to causes. They could give more, but they're giving more money to causes to fight racial injustice and inequities. And so it's good to see that it's no longer happening in the silos, that we're not preaching to the choir, that white people are participating with us on social media when it comes to activism. We just need them to do more. We need them to understand that it goes beyond a hashtag. And we were talking about some white celebs archiving their post or going back into the silent. And it brings up the common issue in a lot of about race and a lot about American culture, and that's capitalism. It's the idea that money comes first. And if it's bad for business, then I'm willing to not voice my opinion. I'm willing to turn the other way. And for so long, white people who have power, who have influence, and who more importantly have money, have been able to hide from these issues. And it's taken the Black Lives Matter movement and the young and semi-young Black activists around the country to say no. Continue paying attention to this. This is important. And I hope that we can continue to leverage social media and the internet for activism. But obviously, it doesn't stop there.
Yeah, absolutely not. And it's so crazy because nothing has remained more consistent in activism than like actually getting out into the streets, marching, chanting, demonstrating with people you know, people you don't know, and, you know, all in all, just being civilly disobedient. With the new age forms of protesting emerging, do you ever think that, I don't know, is it possible for us to shed traditional activism? Is it even necessary for us to shed traditional activism, or do you need both?
I think you need both. I think, to my point earlier, yes, it's great to bring that awareness on social media. It's great to make it a trending topic so that CNN and MSNBC and everyone is locked in on what's happening. But I'm thinking about earlier this year when we saw the George Floyd protests. We knew about his death. We had written about it at The Griot, and so did many other outlets. But it wasn't until people hit the streets where the camera crews were capturing thousands and thousands of people in multiple cities across this nation, demanding that justice be done, not just for George Floyd, but for Ahmaud Arbery, for Breonna Taylor, and for so many people, so many young and old Black people who have been murdered and killed for so long, longer than I care to touch on. And so there's something about civil disobedience in the physical form that really captures the consciousness of Americans and really the world. It didn't just happen here. It happened across the world. And I think nothing will ever beat that. When I think about MLK, my fellow Morehouse brother, who led the most prominent era of civil rights and civil disobedience, it was effective because we saw the numbers. We saw the people on the street. So there's nothing like a visual. It's one thing to see the words, but to see people's cries, to see the signs, to see the crowd, to see police using tear gas and rubber bullets against nonviolent protesters. We need that. We need for, again, white America to see what they have done to this country. And so I think the traditional forms of activism will never go away. But more importantly, there will never be anything more effective.
Yeah, I think we should most definitely always keep the traditional activism. I think the social or digital aspect of that, that's the icing on the cake. Mm. But when you get the real cake, the real flavor is going to be out there in these streets marching, hopefully socially distanced as much as possible, or at least wearing your mask. But, you know, as you said, that is what people take notice of. That is what people pay attention to. Let's see those numbers. Let's see those feet on the ground. Let's see these people who are out here. Here in New York, there was a protest that I actually got like randomly caught up in, sat in traffic for like 20 minutes because it was a bike protest. So it was a bunch of bikers coming down 20th Street on the east side, you know, just rolling and blowing whistles and with their Black Lives Matter posters and such, but trying to hold on while also peddling all these types of crazy things. And I said, you know, it's so crazy. And you know, I'm impatient. I wasn't even annoyed sitting in traffic because I said, although I don't agree, I'm not about to be biking, but although I don't agree with it, I'm seeing these people who have decided that we're going to take this passion that we have for bicycling and we're going to let these voices be heard. These were the same people who were out here bicycling in the goddamn rain. Excuse me? During COVID? Y'all, listen, you get all the props in the world. You out here marching in rain, sleet, snow, have at it. And you know what? I'm so proud of us. And when I say us, that does include allies as well. But I'm proud of us who are making sure that our voices are heard in any way that we can.
Absolutely. And you know, Shauna, another powerful type of protest that has been practiced this year is collective economic activism, where we saw people buying Black, boycotting companies that were not allies, and promoting one another's Black-owned businesses. And I know that I try to support as many Black businesses as possible. So we do that here at Dear Culture, to be honest. This is something that is an ethos here. And I know in my life, I know in your life, Shauna, and I can speak for everyone at the GRIA when it comes to that. But should it have taken COVID and the George Floyd protests for us to begin really saying buy Black?
Necessarily think that that was the catalyst, right? I think it was a further call to action. Like, we've always been doing this buy Black thing, like whether it was our Black biz list, you know, that we do every December or, you know, a larger movement of it. I wish it hadn't taken a global pandemic and the murder of yet another Black person by the hands of police for it to get the amount of traction in the amount of time that it did. But you know what? At this point, honestly, I just want us all to win. So however and wherever and whichever way that we can make that happen, screw it. We'll constantly turn lemons into lemonade. And this is just another, you know, symptom of that.
I like that.
So, you know, we've even seen A-list celebrities and leaders like LeBron James and our forever FLOTUS, Michelle Obama, using their platforms to evoke change. And of course, we've seen ordinary people. Well, I hate that word, ordinary, but you know what I mean. Regular degla folks who've been standing up for justice, whether that's on their jobs, in schools, and any other silos. And I guess my question is, will this only work if we're all in this together? Or hell, does it need to be the celeb speaking out more? Like, put your money on the line. And put your mouth on the line, put your livelihood on the line, because I can protest something and I can say, God forbid, let's knock on wood, but let's say, God forbid, the GRIA did something egregious and I'm like, screw it, I'm out. Well, I'm unemployed during a pandemic. LeBron James should bring his ass in here and come talk about it so I don't have to lose my livelihood during this time. But, you know, I guess, yeah, should we all be in this together? Or, you know, is the onus on a particular subset of us? What do you think?
I think absolutely. We're always stronger in numbers. I think that, yes, a LeBron James, a Michelle Obama, when you have the weight of celebrity and wealth, you should be using that privilege and that power. But I think when we're talking about race and we're talking about income inequality and any injustice, it really is just, I think, a right as a human being, as a global citizen, as an American citizen. We should want to come together. But I think the problem is that we don't all agree on what's right and wrong anymore. It's been hard to see us come together because this president, he's fanned the flames, rather, when it comes to race, when it comes to just the overall division in this country. We can't even agree in parties. We have infighting in the Democratic Party. Even though Republicans don't do it publicly, they have infighting in their party as well. And I'm a bit pessimistic. I mean, I'm an optimistic person, as you know. And I always want to believe that we can lean into the better parts of ourselves to save us from each other. But what I've been witnessing this year in particular has been really unnerving. It makes you wonder, how long will it take for us to really come together? But I think that Donald Trump has been a unifier in the sense that his ignorance and his hateful language has united a lot of different groups. Black people band together with Latinos, with Native Americans, with Asian Americans. Women have band together because, I mean, I think seeing Hillary Clinton lose to a Donald Trump really ignited a new wave in the women's movement. I think that all these movements, as a member of the LGBTQ community, I can definitely say that there's alignment there. That we all see what's problematic about Donald Trump, but more importantly, what's problematic with this country, because Donald Trump is a symptom of a larger issue in this country. And we will never be able to, I think, put out the fires, whether it's race, gender, sexual orientation, until we realize that it's not just a black fight and we fight for black lives, and then women only fight for women's lives and queer people only fight for queer lives. We have to fight for each other's lives. We have to care about each other and not just ourselves. Because we're saying that Donald Trump is problematic because he is a narcissist and only cares about himself, then we have to in turn look to ourselves and question ourselves. Are we only thinking about our own suffering? Are we also thinking about the suffering of others? And when you think from a lens of empathy, better able to band together. I think that the first step is cutting the cancer out. Mm-hmm. Further treatments on America's racism. But I want to turn the conversation to back to young activists, because we've seen allyship throughout this year, white allies in particular. And one of them who has come up a few times on thegrio.com, I believe 15-year-old Claudia Conway, who is the daughter of Kellyanne Conway, Trump's former senior aide or counselor to the president, if you want to get specific. And Claudia Conway has, obviously being Gen Zer, has turned to TikTok and Instagram and Twitter to not only bring attention to racism and injustice, but she's also in the process stuck it to her mom on the internet, including when she announced that her mom had COVID-19. Shauna, my question to you is, do we need white allies?
White people do not listen to us. They only listen to one another. Yes, we need white people. We did not create this problem. They did. It is up to them to fix it. Talk to your racist-ass grandma and grandpa. Talk to your racist-ass husband. Talk to your racist-ass daddy. Talk to your racist-ass fucking bridge club. They don't listen to us. And it's so crazy because we can say the same thing over and over and over and over again. But what happens? Here comes a white guy or a white girl coming out, and all of a sudden, we get it. Now it's legitimate. Now it makes sense. Whoo! But yes, short answer, yes, that is what we need.
Funny you mention that, because there's been a lot of videos on TikTok, actually, of young white teens filming themselves having debates with racist parents. And it's been encouraging. I'm actually really proud of these young white allies, because they're deciding that I don't want to be like my parents. I don't want to be like my grandparents. I don't quite know why that is, but I was reading a bit about Gen Zers when we were prepping for this episode, and the Pew Research Center study said that Gen Z is on track to be the most well-educated generation yet. And I think that there's something to education, because a lot of the things that I learned about my history as an African-American came through my education background, more specifically Morehouse. I think that the New York school system failed us. At Morehouse, I learned a lot. And I think that these young people, these young white teens being more educated is making a difference, because they're the ones who are going to maybe change their parents' mind. And if not, they're the ones, they're next up. They're next up to vote in the next coming election. Some of them are voting in this election coming up in a couple of weeks. And so it is inspiring that they are bringing attention to the issues, to racial inequality, to climate change, gun violence. They've had to see and witness a lot of school shootings. They've witnessed how climate change has been tearing through cities around the country. So they're more aware, and I applaud them for it. We need more Claudia Conways as much as we can to stick it to their parents, their racist parents and their Trump voting parents, because somebody's got to do it. And like you said, I think it's really true that white people only listen to themselves. They are so self-centered. They were reared in the country that always centered them and their thoughts and their faces and their culture. We can have another discussion about white culture, if that's even a thing. Village of other people's cultures. But yeah, maybe it's going to take their children to lead the way instead of the adults in the room.
So, you know, Jaren, those that don't know history are clearly bound to repeat it. So I want to take a look back at some legendary youth activists to help explain why we should take powerful voices seriously, no matter their age. Let's get into a moment of clarity. So, you already brought up your Morehouse brother, but let's talk about Martin Luther King Jr., who was just 26 when he came to prominence by leading the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama. The protest lasted 381 days and ended in victory after the United States Supreme Court ruled that segregation on public buses was unconstitutional. At the age of 35, King became the youngest recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
And John Lewis, the late congressman, at age 17, joined the Civil civil rights movement after learning about the 1955-1956 Montgomery bus boycott on the radio. Inspired, he began to work with Martin Luther King Jr. at age 18. Lewis served on the Atlanta City Council before being elected to Congress and was also a critically acclaimed author. His graphic novel trilogy, March, won a National Book Award. John Lewis once said, quote, "Some of us came to the conclusion that means and ends are inseparable. If we are going to create the beloved community, an open society, if that is our goal, then the means and the methods by which we struggle must be consistent with the end we seek."
Of course. And, you know, then we got to jazz it up a little bit. Let's talk about Yvette Marie Stevens. You know who that is? Let me tell you who Yvette Marie Stevens is. She is known as Chaka Khan, who we love her at The Griot. She is a follower of The Griot. She's a member of The Griot fam. Okay, so I've been talking to Chaka on Instagram. I'm just saying. And, you know, Chaka actually began her activism with the Black Panther Party. She had become friends with Fred Hampton, FBI killed Fred Hampton, by attending Black Panther meetings and events. She, you know, participated in walkouts in high school. I believe she was even arrested in high school for attending, or rather for standing up for educational achievement, you know. And went even beyond that. I believe I read that she would miss her first and second period classes in school to go feed kids with the breakfast program from the Black Panther Party. So, you know, don't get it twisted. Ms. Chaka been out here, all right? And for me, I personally love that we have these elders to look back at, because we've seen young people rise to the occasion time and time again, even today. So, for example, just a few months ago, there was Nia Collins, Jade Fuller, Kennedy Green, Emma Rose McKinney, Kayla Smith, and Z Thomas. This is a group of girls who had never met one another before, right? Until they came together on Twitter to organize a youth march in Nashville after the violent police murder of George Floyd. That's amazing. Thousands of people came and marched with these young ladies. You also have to remember 12-year-old Naomi Wadler. She made her presence and her voice known during the 2019 March for Our Lives rally in DC, when she spoke about the young Black girls who died from gun violence, and her direct quote was, "But don't make it to the front page of every national newspaper." How powerful is that? There's also like environmental activists. There's Isra Hirsi, who's fighting for climate change. And clearly, we can't forget about our celebrity youth activists, right? So there's Yara Shahidi, there's Marseille Martin, there's Marley Diaz, who all are using their platforms in a multitude of ways. I am so proud. The kids gonna be all right. I'm so proud of them.
Are all right. We always hear the children are the future. I mean, the song, right? But it's true. I mean, they are seeing the world as it is, and they're going to inherit the world when a lot of older generations die off. And I'm so happy to see that they are getting involved at an earlier age, because I'm sorry, I hate to admit it, but when I was 15 years old, I wasn't out here in these streets. But this really goes to show that the future can be viewed brightest and most optimistic through the lens of our children's perspective. If we can remove bias and prejudice, and lead with love like these young warriors did and continue to do, we may be able to improve society beyond our own imagination. I'm so inspired by it.
We just gotta try and not kill them off by killing off the planet.
Speaking of powerful young activist voices, we were blessed to receive some words directly from the mouth of a woman who was born into this lifestyle. Our fantastic entertainment director, Courtney Wills, sat down with the late Malcolm X's daughter, Ilyasa Shabazz. Let's check it out.
It is such an honor. I am so excited to be speaking with you. And it is such an opportune time going into this insane election and going through this just insane kind of cycle of social unrest. And so many people in our community, I think, have been struggling to find their footing and to find their place in this fight for social justice. And I've been saying that we have so many voices and so many celebrities and so many ways of conveying information, but what it doesn't seem that we have right now are very clear and visible leaders and people who can show us what participation and activism really looks like. And, you know, speaking to you, who has made such an impact with your own activism and your own work, and obviously, I think, kind of carries your father's legacy through your work, it is definitely a voice that we want to hear from right now. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Just starting off, talk to me a little bit about kind of how you found your footing when it comes to activism.
Well, it was really a way of life. One of the things that my mother focused on raising her six daughters after witnessing her husband's assassination and after living through her home being firebombed, she raised us in this like bubble of love. And as I got older, I realized what was most important to my mother is that her daughters grew up with a strong sense of themselves, that they grew up with a lot of self-love. We learned about the significant contributions women, people of the African diaspora, and Islam made to the world. And so we were very clear with a solid identity. And so what I discovered was that her making sure that we loved ourselves so much. I mean, she was just so amazing. I don't know how she did it. Was to ensure that we did not rely on others' image, others' perceptions, other people to define our own self-worth, our own identity. And so my activism is a result of me being able to see others as a reflection of me. And if I love me, then I love you. And if I see injustice, because she made sure we had a good education, the information that wasn't taught in our schools, we had Sheikh Ahmed Tafiq, who was a scholarship of my father's work. He traveled abroad, he learned, studied, and came back and he taught Malcolm's daughters. And he ensured that we understood history and we saw ourselves as global citizens. And so, of course, quite naturally, when you see injustice, you recognize it and you recognize some of the unfortunate tactics and unfortunate divides and strategies, unfortunately. And so, you know, you want to do something
to
make sure that others are also empowered, inspired. And we're seeing that many people are. And we're seeing actually a lot of leaders in different industries.
Who has been standing out to you? Is there one person or even an organization whose work that you feel like is making an impact or moving the needle or warrants more attention from us?
You know, I think that there are many organizations that I admire. I admire Dream Defenders. I admire the Women's Radical Movement, I think it's called, LeBron James. And then we can look at Brittany Packnett Cunningham and Angela Rye. You know, so I think that there are so many kinds of activists and so many types of leaders. In the 1960s, I think it was different, and 50s, because most of us didn't even know that we weren't Negroes, you know? And so here came Malcolm telling us about our history and that we had an identity and that we actually weren't from Negro lands, but that we were the indigenous people of the Americas. We were the indigenous people of the world. We were also of the African diaspora. And so I would imagine during that time, he really resonated with so many who were looking for themselves. They were trying to find, how do I fit into this global world?
Absolutely. You know, I've been spending a lot of time, I'm the entertainment director, so I'm constantly consuming films and stories. And I've been looking a lot at our history and how our history has been represented in Hollywood, in academia. And it's so striking to me when I look back and I realize how young your father was, kind of at the height of his influence, how young Martin Luther King was, how young John Lewis was when he crossed that bridge in Selma. And I find myself looking around at my peers, people in their 30s and 40s, going, where's the new them? And they were young. They were very young men. And I wonder if now, in this day and age, in this society, we're overlooking the power of the very young people to really be change makers.
That's right. So many young people were politicized through direct actions and protests that took place this summer nearly every single day, right? And so now it is important that we retain the growing base of these young activists and organizers with action-driven dialogue. And so I think it's extremely important that our generation, right, or maybe not yours, but my generation, the elders, have this dialogue, this intergenerational dialogue to say, listen, first of all, we are proud of you. We are proud that you got out there in spite of a global pandemic right? That you have recognized that those in power have misused it and you are demanding change. So I think that, you know, this is really wonderful that we have to make sure that we retain their attention. It's our responsibility. You know, we always heard the elders saying, oh, when I was your age, I did this. It's a shame of what you're doing. But really, we're teaching them. And so we have to recognize our role, our responsibility, and be accountable for this next generation. And then we have to ensure that the next generation coming understands that it's their responsibility to reach back to the next. You know, that we have to preserve our legacies and control the narrative as you are doing ourselves. It's extremely important, especially if we want change. And really what was so great about this moment is that we had people, you know, it was a whirlpool of diversity, right? In this country, 50 states of people from the world who live here in America and 18 countries abroad. And even further, it's our responsibility to make sure that our educational curriculum is inclusive so that we understand that it was our enslaved, refined, and industrious ancestors who helped to cultivate this land and turn it into a land of milk and honey so that every American has the opportunity today to call the United States of America their home. But it's our responsibility to make sure that we honor our ancestors that did all of that work, that tireless work, and that we control the narrative of their struggles, their sacrifices, their trauma, you know, ourselves. I think that more than anything is extremely important because we speak about political power, but there's no political power without economic power. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's our responsibility just to make sure that we are really honing in on our legacy and preserving something for the future, that it's not only about today, but it's about being organized and strategic and all of the things that are necessary to ensure that our interests are being protected.
I really want to thank Courtney for that insightful interview with Ilyasa Shabazz. I appreciate like so much how she recognized that it's our responsibility to control our own narratives and support young activists. Clearly, it's imperative.
We want to remind our listeners to support your local Black businesses and donate to your local organizations and religious institutions. This week, we're highlighting Little Miss Flint Clean Water Fund. Since the age of 8, Mari Coppany, also known as Little Miss Flint, has been trying to ensure her community has access to safe and clean water. It's been 5 years since her Clean Water Fund started, and still, Flint is in need of safe drinking water. Donate to the Little Miss Flint Clean Water Fund by visiting maricoppany.com and click the Help Give Back tab. The Griot has published a list of 50 plus Black businesses to support during the coronavirus pandemic. If you'd like your business to be featured, email us at info@thegriot.com. That's GRIO.com.
Thank you for listening to Dear Culture. If you like what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast and share it with everyone you know.
And please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments. We love those. To podcast@thegriot.com. The Dear Culture podcast is brought to you by The Griot and executive produced by Blue Talusma and co-produced by Sundas Hassan, Kyrie Williams, and Kevin Y. Brown. We love you.